we were going to record this an hour ago, but then we discovered a 90s boy band marathon on music TV channel The Vault, so it's a bit late, sorry.
Boy bands.
Hello!
Hello.
And welcome to whatever number episode of Season to Taste this is. In the last episode, we decided that we were going to watch The Underwater Menace. And we did make a small error in that we worked on the basis that episode 2 exists, which it now does. But it hasn't actually been released on DVD.
Well, it's always existed.
It has always existed. It hasn't come
back.
Well,
since 1966.
Yes. So, fortunately, Matt and I did watch The Underwater Menace episode 2 at the BFI Missing Believed White, where it was shown. So we combined that with the audio and telesnaps to make it as if we have in fact just watched it, along with episode 3 and the audio of episode 1 and episode 4. So, Matt, how did you find Doctor Who and the Underwater Menaces?
Yeah, it's camp old nonsense, but inoffensive, I thought.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I thought as well. There isn't really all that much to it. It's kind of entertaining. It involves a massive amount of running around. There is one bit in episode 3 where Polly literally gets kind of captured for 2 minutes and then rescued, and nothing about it moves the plot on. It just pads out the episode with a bit more apparent action. It's interesting that some of the things that have been historically thought of as bad about it, like the fish people and Professor Zaroff, I actually didn't mind that much. I think in context, the whole idea of the fish people is wonderfully horrible. The idea of the Atlanteans, and we are back in Atlantis after having watched The Time Monster for season 9. And it's quite similar, actually, some of it. The king and that kind of old Greek-style approach is quite similar. But the fish people, it's really horrible, the idea that they basically genetically modify, or they, you know, stick gills in. Very Babylon 5 style.
I mean, that the injection, Polly's preparation for being changed into a fish person is probably the only genuinely scary and unpleasant bit in the whole of the 4 episodes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's needles, she's being strapped down, there's this horrible sense of, you know, medical horror happening around her. No wonder the Australians cut that bit to buggery.
Yeah, which it messes it up because it's actually the cliffhanger, and so
yeah.
It must have looked a bit weird. I mean, actually, there's one other moment that is surprisingly nasty, which is when the priest gets speared in the back by Professor Zaroff.
Yeah, that's nasty as well. It happens off screen, but that's nasty. I think Polly trumps it in the horror status because it's a much more everyday kind of horror. The focus on the needles, and it's Polly, a character that we know, being strapped down. And I just think there's something particularly, for a child, there's something particularly nasty about that sequence.
Mm. Not to dart off on another topic straight away, but actually that's just reminded me of the odd thing. You mentioned a character we know. The odd thing about the cliffhanger to episode 3, which is the notorious "Nothing in the World Can Stop Me Now" cliffhanger, is that the Doctor isn't in that scene. None of the regulars are in that scene. It's Professor Zaroff talking to the King, or the King is just killed, or shot anyway. It's not like the Doctor, you know, in the 80s, there'd be a big crash zoom on Colin Baker's face after that had been declared to him. The Doctor's not even in the room when he shouts that.
No. But then, I think it's something about Zaroff, isn't it? He's a fantastically strange character. I think he holds the whole thing together, really. It isn't over-the-top performance, but it's exactly the performance that the story requires, because it's an over-the-top mad scientist role.
He's perhaps the first mad scientist, like proper, traditional-style mad scientist in Doctor Who, do you think?
Probably, actually. I haven't really thought about it. There's a mad scientist, isn't there, in The Keys of Marinus in one of the zones, but I can't really remember.
Mm. But yeah, he's very much, as in he's properly insane. And so, although you have that massively overacted, ridiculous phrase at the end of episode 3, it is in keeping with how his character is.
Yeah, but you wouldn't really want him to mumble it in a kind of Brando-ish way, would you? I mean, he has to deliver it.
It's the cliffhanger.
In that kind of melodramatic way, because it's a melodramatic role.
Yeah.
I think what's particularly interesting about Zaroff is that it's not the most instinctive place to find a mad scientist in the ruins of Atlantis, beneath the sea, and it's not the most obvious time to set a story on Atlantis, is it, in the late 1960s or early 1970s, whenever it's meant to be set. When I actually thought about the kind of premise of the story, Atlantis in the present day, it's been sunk for centuries, it's in about 1970, and the whole place has been taken over by a mad German scientist. The whole thing is a really strange kind of setup that you can only imagine really happening in a story in the 60s. It's like one of those weird Amicus films where there's German U-boats fighting dinosaurs or something like that. It just smacks. It's such a 60s premise. I can't imagine anyone ever having that idea for a story in the 80s or 90s. And I think it probably fits with the kind of children's and action adventure TV series around that time. You can imagine Thunderbirds doing that kind of plot, but I can't imagine Doctor Who at any other point in its history tackling such a strange mishmash of ideas.
And it's weird because it does just throw characters in, like Sean, the Irish comedy character, who's sent off to convince the fish people to go on strike. It's like Carry On at Your Convenience suddenly in the middle of...
I was watching it and just thinking, the culture that this came from and the whole TV style of it is totally lost now. I think it would be impossible to make anything like The Underwater Menace in the 21st century.
We said the bit with the fish people is reminiscent of The Web Planet, where they're just kind of doing their
weird dance
and floating around. And yeah, Sean, his speech to them to convince them to go on strike is like a really short 1 minute they're throwing food at him, and then 30 seconds later he's convinced them to all go on strike. Not that it really makes any difference to the plot that they're going on strike by that point. He is just a kind of flat comedy character. Him and Jacko, it gives Ben and Jamie someone else to talk to, but neither of them has any real background. You don't really know who they are or what they're like. They're pleasant enough, but they're very two-dimensional characters.
The whole story, and I think it particularly in the two episodes that you can watch, does feel like it's an opportunity for Patrick Troughton and Joseph First to camp it up a little bit and go over the top.
There's a bit at the beginning of episode three where the two characters, the Doctor and Zaroff, are basically each of them trying to have the last line in the scene, and it's really fun as they go back and forth with each other trying to outdo each other.
But the good thing is both of them actually rise to the occasion. I know Joseph First's performance has been criticised, I think, quite a lot, but I think when I was watching it, I just don't see how else you really play it other than, you know, it's with your hair all over the place, mad-eyed scientist. The character's explicitly mad in the script, so unless you're going to go for the Brando school of realism and have him as a kind of mumbling, method-acting kind of character, which would then look completely out of place in this bizarre
comic book world
where people wear costumes made out of shells and shell headdresses and it's bikinis and things like that.
It's a mention what things are made of in the bad audio interview at the end of the audio disc with Annika Wills. She criticises the sets and says, you know, it's quite embarrassing acting in front of those sets when we were doing our best, but actually on screen they look fine. I didn't think there was particularly, you know, there's a huge temple bit. I mean, it's not massive, but it looks fine, and the lab sets are fine.
Yeah, I think it looks slightly sparse. I mean, the giant Amdo face is obviously the most expensive set. The rest of it doesn't look especially lavish, but it doesn't look the most threadbare thing.
It might be the when you're standing next to it, it looks really ropey, but actually once it's in black and white film, it's
smeary black and white film conceals a host of sins.
And it's interesting seeing something so early in the earliest surviving episodes of
Troughton.
And seeing him in a much more playful attitude than he is in season six, and dressing up. You know, he wears funny hats, he puts other costumes on. In episode three, he dresses as Roy Orbison. He makes little jokes. He says things like, women and children last.
Yeah.
He does the thing that David Tennant, in Human Nature, when David Tennant kind of falls over all the switches when he's pretending to be
John Smith. Yeah.
And there's the bit where he's just bumbling around, accidentally
pulls the kind of cable out and then puts his finger in his mouth, as though, ooh, how did I do? Oh,
did I accidentally switch off the power?
What a silly cow!
Yeah.
But I think that's true of Troughton. I think that's true of every Doctor. Their performances do change as the run goes on.
I wonder whether it's much more of a reaction to Hartnell at that point as well. And so he's a much more light, jolly, slightly silly Doctor. Mm. Silly is not the right word, but kind of comedy bumbling and dressing up and stuff. Just the First Doctor would never really...
I don't know. The First Doctor wasn't averse to a bit of comedy, but I mean in The Gunfighters when he's wandering around holding his mouth because his tooth hurts with the gun dangling from his finger.
He bumbles around in the Romans, actually. Doesn't.
I mean, Hartnell was a good comedy actor. It was maybe some of the more dramatic stuff that he doesn't always come off as well as it might.
Yeah. But it's interesting how the story develops as well, in as much as there isn't really a story. And so you have early on a lot of kind of being captured, and all the way through there's a lot of capture, escape. Early on, there's a real Batman or James Bond-style thing with the piranha pit that they tried to describe in episode one that just sounds like... It sounds like a bad Crystal Maze challenge or something. It's very bizarre.
I think that's one of the times where you think, it's such a shame that these episodes have been destroyed because the audio description and the telesnaps just are not up to describing the strangeness of what's happening on screen. It becomes very difficult to actually picture what's supposed to be coming on because the narration almost tries to be too precise about what it's describing, and you almost just want to say, the three of them are suspended over a shark pit.
I think there are a lot of bad choices in the narration about quite how much description and explanation to put in. I think it rather overdoes it. It's also, of course, Jamie's first trip in the TARDIS, and it's there at the beginning when they're talking about where they're going. But Jamie then settles in extremely quickly and is just a natural part of the team, isn't he?
Well, I think if it's true that Fraser Hines was a very late addition to the cast and that he just inherited some of Ben and Polly's lines, I think you can see how that might work. Ben would just have got the plot to incite the fish person rebellion and been sent to the mines. Polly would have been sent to be a fish person, and there's not really a separate role for Jamie, so he doesn't really do anything of note in the story.
Yeah.
But Fraser Hines is likeable enough that you don't really notice that.
No. I just remembered one of the other lines in the narration that I thought was a nice example of the approach of it. It was the line Annika Wills has to say, her face a hybrid of woman and fish. Which is just...
You've just reminded me of the bit that I did laugh out loud at, I think, in episode three, when I think it's the Doctor, Ben and Jamie have all got these kind of fish masks on sticks in front of their faces in the temple. And then as one, they all take the fish mask away to reveal themselves in their full glory.
Tis I, Leclerc.
it just did tickle me quite a lot. But it does revel in its dressing up, doesn't it? It's got the Doctor in that bizarre bandana.
Oh, yeah.
Sunglasses with a tambourine.
Well, that's his Roy Orbison. He's got Roy Orbison's glasses on. There's amazing hat work in the whole thing. I mean, the priest has this ridiculous bamboo or whatever that is hat, and it's just so over the top.
It looks like something that you put on, you know, a 1980s buffet. It looks like there should be like pineapple chunks sticking out.
It is really, but there are glorious hats.
The Doctor gets to wear one as well, much to his delight. I think in the second episode, Troughton has this early thing, doesn't he, of wanting to have...
Does he have the stovepipe hat in the description at some point?
I can't remember, but he early on in his run, he loves to have different hats. And his eyes light up when he sees the opportunity of wearing this bizarre Atlantean priest's hat. And he seems to take to that with great delight.
And the Atlantean priest, isn't it? I remember watching him in the 90s in the BBC series Cardiac Arrest. He was one of the doctors in that, the priest. And speaking of guest actors, one of the joys of the Underwater Menace is Colin Jeevans in full-on camp mode.
With giant eyebrows.
It's ridiculous. Atlantean eyebrows, which I like to think were ginger in real life, a bit like the Andragums.
I was going to say, are they secretly Andragums?
Colin Jeevans just chewing the whole, you know, I mean, the scenery such as it is probably didn't have much nutritional value, but he's going for every calorie.
Lisping with anger. Hands on hips and... You know, lips
well, I don't know, Zaroff.
Lips pursed furiously. It's just a beautifully camp performance.
I do. I love him in that. I mean, he's of course Stamper in House of Cards.
Stabbing his little toy.
Yeah, is it Canine and Company he comes back in as well? And he's brilliant in that Adam Adamant Lives where he plays the fashion designer.
Yes. It's called To Set a Deadly Fashion.
It's called To Set a Deadly Fashion. I'm sure it has the line, I swear he says the line in it, executed in Grecian drapes. Because they're assassins, aren't they? They're assassins posing as a fashion house.
Adam Adamant did have some very amusing episode titles as well.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, that it just sums up why I love Colin G. Because he'll just camp his way round whatever. He's still alive as well. He's about 90.
I found out Philip Latham's still alive from The Five Doctors this
really?
Morning. He's barely alive in The Five Doctors.
He has got immortality now.
Yeah, is he just like a face on? Just a face on. Someone's tomb.
Colin Jevons is 80. He's only 84. I say only, but Peter Vaughan was in Game of Thrones.
Well, for the 50th anniversary, I will be outraged if Daemon doesn't make a comeback.
If Daemon is not in the 50th anniversary special, then they may as well not have bothered. And yeah. I will be writing a strongly worded letter to ITV.
Yeah. The only two things I wanted from the 50th anniversary special were Paul McGann regenerating into Christopher Eccleston, with both Paul McGann and Christopher Eccleston appearing, and Daemon appearing as well. If those aren't in it, then Moffat must go.
And Colin Jevons must come.
But I think that's important about the Underwater Menace. I know it's by no means the best story, but it is obviously a comedy, and I think anyone who tries to tackle it as a in any way serious story worthy of you know, chin stroking discussion is fooling themselves. It's like the Space Museum. It's a disposable fun, and you can be critical of that and say Doctor Who should strive for more than it. But yeah, I think it made me laugh.
Yeah,
it kept me entertained.
There's an interesting bit in side thought. There's an interesting bit in early on when they're trying to work out what the time is that they've arrived in, because there's a coin that mentions the Mexico Olympics, which must have been 68, and so Polly says, well, this must be about 1970 or something, because we've got a coin that mentions the Mexico Olympics, which hadn't happened when it was made, but obviously they knew where they were going to be, which is quite like Fear Her using a future Olympics that they know is going to happen. But it's also quite like An Unearthly Child, where Susan talks about, oh, you haven't had gone decimal yet.
Yeah.
But actually they knew they were going to go
decimal,
even by 1963, I think, didn't they?
Yeah.
And so it's using something you know is going to happen in the future to give it that extra little reality of time travel and cleverness. I like the bit where they meet the Atlanteans and are trying to speak foreign to them. And like Jamie talks Gaelic, and there's a bit of bad French in there. And what else did I like about it? Oh, every time anyone says under the sea, I just thought of the Simpsons Under the Sea.
Under the sea, there'll be no accusations, just friendly crustaceans under the sea.
Yeah, that's the... Every time anyone said, but we're under the sea, I just started...
That's your answer to everything. Go and live under the sea. It's not going to happen.
Not with that attitude. Endlessly quotable. Obviously, there's the moment where the Doctor leaves a note signed Dr. W.
Yes.
And where he's forgotten that his own name isn't Doctor Who.
Or is it? No, it's not.
No. But overall, yeah, I mean, it's quite flawed. It's padded to buggery with running around back and forth.
Yeah.
But I quite enjoy it, and I enjoy it mainly for Troughton just having a lot of fun and the characters being very watchable.
I'm almost exactly on the same page as you. Julia Smith gets slagged off in the interview that you were talking about earlier, but I think I look
it's
at bits of it.
Quite nicely directed, actually.
And the kind of, given the size of the set, the bits where the Doctor's running rings around the guards in the marketplace are actually quite dynamically directed. Mm. There's some really clever bits, and then suddenly there'll be a really slow and static bit. But overall, I think it's not going to win any prizes for plot, logic, coherence, acting, or anything. And yet it's still a more entertaining story than some of the ones that we've watched. And I love it for the same reason that I love something like Time in the Rani, in that it's just fun. And it doesn't strive to be anything more.
We mentioned the Time Monster, and you know, the Doctor and Zaroff and the Doctor and the Master camping around in the Time Monster are part of what makes them not very good but fun.
Yeah. And unlike the Time Monster, the Underwater Menace hasn't got a ponderous four-episode setup.
No, that's, yeah, and it's two episodes shorter, so yay.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that is season four and our second Patrick Troughton. Only season five left from him. Well, actually, our third, if you count Three Doctors, I suppose. Great. Let's bring on the randomizer and see which season we taste next.
I'll wheel it in.
I found the plug socket, so the randomizer is all set up. Just a reminder that we still haven't had any Hartnell, we haven't had any David Tennant, and actually there's a huge sway from about season 11 to season 22 that we haven't had. That means we've also done no Tom and no Peter.
Mm.
Will that change now?
I don't know. Let's find out.
This is the nature of a random choice. Okay, let's ask the randomizer to pick a season to taste. Right, well, the randomizer has made its choice, and it's a Doctor we haven't yet done.
Mm.
Statistically, one is more likely than the others, and it is indeed Tom Baker.
Okay.
And it is season 18.
Oh.
So, John Nathan Turner's first season, mm-hmm. and that means there's quite a few to choose from. The Leisure Hive, Meiglos,
yep.
Full Circle, mm-hmm. State of Decay, Warrior's Gate, The Keeper of Traken, and Logopolis, as Matt Smith pronounced it. So, I have some...
Traken. I think every planet he visits he should now pronounce wrong, so it should be Argolis, Traken, Logopolis.
You're thinking of the Kraken of Treeper.
Statue monster. Of Decay. Alcibiades.
Legosm. Shader.
front arse.
You're thinking of Cash Devolver. do you know what? There's not a specifically wanted discount. I've got some ideas. How shall we play this? I mean, you hate Legopolis.
Have you warmed
to it in recent years?
I don't hate Legopolis. I think it's a very strange script, but once I worked out that it's basically just a way of trying to write Tom Baker out of the series and the story doesn't really matter, then I was much happier with it.
Right, well, let's... What approach... I mean, I think we could basically pick any of them. There are a few I haven't seen for some time. There are some I've seen. I've seen The Keeper of Traken was the first I ever bought on video, so I've seen The Keeper of Traken a lot. But I really like it, so I would have to watch it again. And I've seen Legopolis a lot. I think mm-hmm. that trilogy with Cash Devolver. And I do like, it is a chance to see the introduction of the Alien Master. But, you know, The Leisure Hive is a chance to see the very introduction of JNT and the new look.
I really don't like The Leisure Hive at all. I think it's a very dull story.
Not that that's a reason that we shouldn't watch it, but I'd rather not watch a dull one.
Yeah.
Meiglos is the one I've seen the least. I think I've only seen it once. Obviously, it's got Jacqueline Hill in it.
It's one of those stories where it's been on while I've been in the room, but I don't think I've ever.
I can't really tell you what it's about. I think there's some kind of polyhedron in it.
The dodecahedron. And it's Barbara with a funny ponytail. That's what I really remember.
Full Circle I really like. I think it's got some great ideas in it. And I'd be quite interested in that. I know it quite well.
I think it's the one that season... No, one of maybe two that season that really get this kind of science fiction approach that Christopher Bidmead, the script editor, wanted to...
Let's make a piece of science a key to the plot, but let's not overwhelm the story with it.
But it's about... I think a lot of Bidmead stories are actually about trying to understand the world that you're in and engage with it. And once the Doctor understands what Alzarius is all about and he understands how the planet works, that's the key to the plot. I think the same in Warrior's Gate, once people start to understand how this weird environment works, they understand their way through. And that's where I think Bidmead stuff is really powerful, because it's actually about engaging with the world around you and trying to work out how it works, rather than, oh, there's a button that we're just going to press to solve the plot.
When we were doing... when we were doing our Who Watch many years ago, State of Decay was where we got to, I think, and then didn't get past, didn't finish.
Oh, God.
So I think the last time I saw that was like half of State of Decay many years ago. Warrior's Gate, I haven't seen in a very long time and don't really remember. I remember it much better from the book. That's obviously a Stephen Gallagher one, so it's... Yeah. He's a very established writer now, and then Trachten and Legopolis. So I think let's discount the Leisure Hive. I didn't really want to watch State of Decay. I didn't have much.
It's one of those stories. As a child, I loved it because it had vampires in, and I think it looks absolutely splendid. But I have no great urge to watch it.
No, it is obviously Matthew Waterhouse's first
appearance,
first recorded. Yeah. I mean, what do we want? Do we want something that represents the Bidmead era? In which case, maybe Full Circle is a good one to go for. Or do we want something that's a bit different, like Warrior's Gate?
Well, I think Warrior's Gate would be both, because I think it's both representative of Bidmead's approach, but it's also a very different kind of script. I think Warrior's Gate is quite interesting. I'm quite warming to the idea of watching that, having not seen it for a long time.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a very long time. And it's obviously when Romana leaves and K-9 leaves, it's got that element of the ending of Tom's era.
Yeah.
That you get much more, obviously, in Legopolis, but there's lovely hints at the end of Chalk and, like, the Master lead coming back and leading into it, the 4 minutes to midnight on the clock at the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd say let's go for Warrior's Gate. I haven't seen it in a very long time, and it's certainly got lots of interesting ideas we talk about.
Yeah. Let's do Warrior's Gate.
Great. Warrior's Gate it is. We will see you in eSpace. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I like that Ben does something really clever when he does Ando's voice from behind to help the Doctor escape. Yeah. And, of course, Ben Ando is a BBC reporter. Thanks for that. I'll cut that out.